Near-Death Experience Podcast, an ongoing exploration of spiritually transformative experiences, including NDEs and other phenomena, in order to elucidate the ineffable and better understand our spirituality. All episodes are available at ndepodcast.org. The views expressed and opinions given by the individual hosts and guests are not necessarily those of NDE Podcast, the NDERF, any sponsors, or for that matter, anyone else. In the end, the only opinion that really matters is yours.
Welcome to Near Death Experience Podcast, the official source of audio accounts for the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. I'm Chaz Hathaway, author of Life in the Spirit World, What Near-Death Experiences May Teach About Life on the Other Side, and the music album Home. Today we're going to share the experience of Pat from NDERF.org, the Near-Death Experience Research Foundation website. Pat says, "My first NDE, accidentally, I have had a couple, occurred when I was a child of 7. I did not go through a tunnel. I was vaulted into the sky. I had been ill most of my childhood with strep throat and tonsillitis. That was back in the 1950s when doctors were using large injections of penicillin. As a result of receiving far too many shots, my body developed a resistance and finally went into anaphylactic shock. My temperature went off the scale of the thermometer, over 108 degrees. When that happened, I went up into the sky. I had been feeling quite awful, lying on the couch at home, when suddenly I found myself in the sky. I didn't question the fact that I was there. I just enjoyed it with the delight of a child. I found I could make any kind of movement I pleased and had no restrictions. I still had a sense of body, but I could freely twist and turn any direction I chose. I was doing barrel rolls and big swoop turns, sky dancing. I came to a place of opalescent color all over the clouds. It was wonderfully pretty. Gold, lemon yellow, rose, orange, lime green, sparkling like pearlescence. Then a being came up to me, and I must confess, in retrospect, that it looked exactly like the image of the Father God I had been taught in school. But at the time, I didn't think it was God, nor know who it was. That's just what he looked like. He came up to me in a kind of mind-to-mind transference of thought. He rather shouted in my mind, 'What are you doing here now?' I stopped, as if the principal at school had collared me, and wondered how this man knew who I was, because I had never seen him before in my life. He was waiting for an answer, so, in pure child fashion, I replied, 'I don't know.' And I didn't. I had no idea how I'd gotten there. I hadn't even thought about it. I was just having fun. Then he got real concerned and said, 'You're not supposed to be here yet. You better go back down right now.' Fortunately for me, I was a well-behaved child, and it didn't occur to me to do otherwise. The next thing I knew, I was opening my eyes to see, of all things, the face of the family doctor pulling away from me with his hands flailing and an expression of pure shock, as if he were scared out of his wits. Maybe I should try to paint that someday. He must have thought I was dead. I think he was trying to figure out what to say to my mother when I opened my eyes and looked at him. He was really honestly scared. I haven't told the experience to very many people until now. It seemed too personal and not exactly the kind of thing one would relate in casual conversation. Usually I mention it to people who are fearful of death or who have lost a loved one. I tell them about it because I really do believe there is a place we go to. It sure felt like it to me. And the thing that really makes me think the materialistic analytics are wrong when they say that these experiences are only physical and have no other basis is that the person I met was a complete stranger to me, and I was really stunned that he knew who I was. I didn't think it was God, but in my memory, I have to admit that he looked like the image of people make of the old Father God. The thing is, however, in the midst of the experience, I didn't put that together. I just wondered how the heck he knew who I was, and wondered who in the world he was, because I had never met him before. Anyway, that was when I was a child. Later in life, I must admit to being quite stupid. Out of your cotton picking mind, one acquaintance has said regarding the second accidental near-death experience. I have a friend who is a doctor, and back in the late 1980s, he was into this idea of exercising the automatic nervous system. I won't tell you what we did because I don't want to give any kids stupid ideas of things to try that are potentially fatal. The end result of my particularly foolhardy exercise was to go into hypothermia, convulsions, the works. It was pretty darn awful. At the start of it, when my body began to shake uncontrollably, I felt a serious sense of nausea overwhelming me. The thought went through my mind, oh, this doesn't feel very good at all. The next instant, I was face to face with infinity, a huge ball of light, out of which came a zillion number of the finest red filaments, like laser lights shooting out to every single atom in the universe. And what's more, from every single atom to every single other atom, all interconnected entirely to each other and back again to the source. My poor brain could hardly fathom it. It was huge. It was immense. It was beyond belief. To look at it felt like 10,000 lightning bolts were exploding all at once in my brain. It hurt. I screamed, "Stop! You're going to break my mind to pieces!" The image softened and then turned into something I could look at. A few years later, I saw something that looked like it in Chinatown. It was called the Chinese God of Destruction. It very nearly destroyed me. Then everything went black, and I could feel myself lying on the ground. The horrible shaking had stopped, but I had a sickening sense that all the energy that was me, all of my life force, or whatever you call it, was draining out through my stomach. I thought, I'm dying. I didn't want to die there. It was stupid. I was stupid. People would get into trouble because of it. I had things to do. I pulled back on the energy. I sucked back with all of my willpower and pulled it all back into myself and held on to it. Then I realized that I had to stay awake, that I couldn't pass out or go to sleep because then the energy might slip out again and I wouldn't be there to pull it back in again. Oh, let me tell you, for 10 hours I kept myself awake until all the symptoms subsided. Excruciating headache, terrible nausea, a feeling of nearly passing out at any moment, holding on by my fingernails, so to speak. There were no doctors where I was. There was no one to look after me. I had to simply stay conscious. And I did. Finally, the symptoms began to wear off. I began to feel semi-normal. I think solid would be a good word for it, and I decided that I could safely go to sleep. I wrote to my friend and described what had happened, that I felt like I was dying. He wrote back that what I described was classic hypothermia, and it is usually fatal. He said regarding my sense of dying, "You probably were." from these two near-death experiences, I've learned a couple of things. From the first, in good child form, I got the impression that there were lessons I needed to learn, and that if I learned them quickly, I could play the rest of my life. It seemed that there was a certain amount of time allotted to this lesson learning, and if I was astute, I could get through it and then play. I do not believe I have been very good at the lessons. However, quite a few folks have said that it looks like I'm playing all the time these days. Who knows? Maybe I am. From the second experience, I got the impression that we are baby beings in the universe, that our bodies are sheaths for our consciousness. They protect us from perceiving all that is. We have five senses, and they are dampers on our perceptions, giving us only the amount of information that we are able to assimilate and react to. I am very grateful for that. As a result, I paint clouds and other things too. I've just begun a series of landscape paintings that I'm working to capture an essential light. It is an intellectual, emotional thing. Paths on the path, bathed in sunlight, intense sunlight, on the path toward light, archangels, thresholds, and doorways. That is the end of Pat's experience. Now, there's a couple of things I want to say about this, first of all. First off, I swear I remember reading this, so I apologize if I am repeating this. I have a bookmark of a lineup of experiences to share, and sometimes I forget to delete them from the list after I've read them. I'm going to go ahead and delete this now so I don't read it a third time if I have read it before. I did go back and look at names of the recordings. I usually put the name of the person in the recording, and I couldn't find one with Pat. So it's possible that I just read this or intended to read it just for myself, and just can't remember, whether I actually shared it or not. But I couldn't find evidence of having shared it, so I apologize if I have. Okay, that's my first thought. But my next one, because this is what stands out more than just about anything else in this one to me, is that Pat says that she thinks that our bodies are here to protect us from perceiving all that is. Now, I'm not going to suggest even for a moment that we shouldn't seek out God, that we shouldn't seek out all that is as best we can while we're here. I think we should. I think we need that. We need that balance in our lives. But I do think it's fair to suggest that our reason for being here is not to try to weasel our way back while in our bodies. I don't think we're intended to, most of us anyway, to have experiences where we visit the spirit world. Some people, absolutely, it is. That becomes clear from near-death experiences. But I don't think it's intended that we all do. I do think it's intended that we experience some level of spiritual transformation, whether that be through a spiritually transformative experience or through, religious experience, fervor, so forth. Things that bring us closer to God, more one with the universe, more connected to life around us and to God. I think that very much is intended. But if we're trying to escape life by stepping out, spending hours and hours meditating a day in order to try to be in heaven and escape this world that we're in, I think we've got it a little bit wrong. We're misbalanced in that way. And I don't know how much of it is that we're here to play, like Pat says, once she accomplished her purpose, she was going to be given time to play. Maybe many of us are. Maybe many of us are in that situation even. And I don't think that means do whatever you want, and waste your life, ruin your body, you know, with chemical and you know, addictive behavior. I don't think that's what it means at all. I think it means that so long as we are seeking to live with purpose and love and with, you know, close to God and so forth, then I think we should be trying to enjoy our lives and play and dance and run and paint and do the things that bring us spiritual, emotional, social joy and make us feel alive. I think that's very much intended. It just strikes me as interesting that the body that we have is there not just to hide us from knowing all that is, but to protect us from perceiving all that is. That suggests to me that we are supposed to forget. We are supposed to not remember. And that doesn't mean we shouldn't seek the memory or seek to reinstate that relationship that we have with the divine. We absolutely should. But it should be done from a place of not remembering, which sounds like a contradiction. If we could just jog that memory, couldn't it just pop back into our lives, the memory of who we are, what we're here for, and who God is, and you know what it all means? That wouldn't it be beneficial for us to just get that information? I'm not sure it is, but to seek that information is powerful. Which again sounds like a contradiction, but it really isn't. And something worth thinking about. Let's talk a little bit about just this interesting and beautiful description that she gives of the light. And I don't know what else to call it. This huge ball of light, as she puts it, out of which came a zillion number of the finest red filaments, like laser lights, shooting out in every single atom, shooting out of every single atom in the universe, and to every single atom, all of them interconnected. I'm picturing this, you know, almost like a laser show where every inch has a laser zapping outward toward every other laser. And it's interesting that she says every single atom in the universe, because, you know, from our limited mortal perspective, if you were to simply have a laser shining from every atom in every direction, well, isn't that the same thing as just having one big, massive, bright light? And perhaps that is so, but let's keep in mind that in the spirit form, you're able to perceive things so much more infinitely, so much more intricately, such that some people perceive individual atoms moving and bustling between each other and in their formations and in their rotations, and they perceive them as each one individually and yet operating as one great whole. They see this and they recognize it. And I don't know how that works, because, you know, if I'm even looking at a, you know, graphic of several atoms, or, you know, something that's supposed to represent atoms, you know, with rotating electrons and whatever, and there's five of them on the board, I can't be concentrating on more than one at a time. And even then, I can't be concentrating on what exactly is going on with it from every angle. But in the spirit form, it appears that one can, and that that's not strange at all. So having lasers shooting to every, you know, into other lasers, you know, or atoms shooting out lasers to every other atom in the universe sounds crazy to us, but sounds very consistent with things that I read in near-death experiences. Beautiful and fascinating. And we did briefly touch on this, but I want to read it again. She's summarizing what she learns from the experience, and she says, from the first experience, she says, in good child form, I got the impression that there were lessons that I needed to learn and that if I learned them quickly, I could play the rest of my life. So very childlike kind of an idea. Think of a kindergartner. If you finish that, reading that Dick and Jane book, in time, you can go to recess early and go play. It's kind of that feeling. And yet, aren't we children spiritually? Aren't we so driven by, reward and by, our own version of play and the things that we want and the things that we desire? We're very childlike in our spirits. And it's true that our bodies, lead us to become more mature in our attitudes and the way we approach life. Hopefully they do anyway, most of us. But it's like our spirits are growing up much slower. And I think, who knows, maybe that's one of the reasons why old people will still say, I still feel like a teenager. I still feel like a child. Just in this big old body. It could be that we are children in spirit. And there is this desire to play. And of course, that doesn't necessarily mean play with dolls and Legos and so forth. But, she talks about how when she came back, she became more creative. And she says, now I paint clouds and landscapes and so forth. This beauty and creativity and curiosity, that's all part of our spiritual play, as I gather, but also part of our spiritual lessons. It's part of our essence, that part of us that wants to go out to recess, the part that wants to be creative and explore and so forth. And that's not a bad thing. But I do think it's worth noting that she says that she needed to learn these certain lessons. Now, what lessons? We talk a lot about purpose, about our purpose on this earth and so forth, and how it can be challenging to discover our purpose or find out our purpose, whatever. But what about the lessons? We don't talk as much about that in this podcast. And perhaps I'm doing us a disservice by not touching on that more. The lessons that we're here to learn. And if you think about it in this childlike way that we come to learn these lessons, and if we learn those lessons, then our life can open up to, to play, so to speak. What lessons might we be learning? And might I suggest that unless we've lived a really fulfilling life and feel like we've fulfilled our purposes and are now just struggling to find our way in other ways, most of us, it could be, if there is suffering, if there is a sense of, things not being right in our lives, I would offer that as a suggestion that we are still in that lesson stage. Have you ever noticed how many elderly people who have lived a full life feel rather fulfilled, rather ready to go when the time comes? I have a suspicion that one of the reasons for that is because they fulfilled their life purpose. They've learned the lessons they came here to learn. And does that mean there's nothing else they can learn? Of course not. They can always learn more. But it's like going to university, getting your degree, let's even say master's or even doctorate degree. Does getting your doctorate degree mean that there's nothing else that the college could teach you? Well, of course not. There's endless amounts of things you could learn while you're here. But those things that we set out to learn in coming here, that degree, if you will, those specific lessons that we sought out to learn or that God wanted us to learn, we are here to learn those lessons. We're still in the middle of exams. We're still in the middle of our study periods. If we are in positions of suffering or difficulty or stress in some way, I suspect anyway that that's the case. So the reason I say that is because it could really do us a lot of good and help speed up the process. if we will take moments, perhaps in meditation, in prayer, in quiet, on a quiet walk, and so forth, to think about what could I be here to learn? What is it specifically that my suffering right now has potential to teach me? What is it that I could learn from this? That's what it comes down to. What do I need to learn from this experience? And I can promise you, because we are so entrenched in this mortal experience, the moment that you start to touch on the answer, the moment you even begin to get a hint of what the answer will be, our mortal mind will step in and say, yeah, but this, and will try to distract us from figuring out exactly what that lesson is. But if we can bypass that and say, okay, yeah, I get it. There are obstacles to this seeming lesson or solution. There are problems with it. But let's look into it anyway. What could I learn from this? Let's just use the example of, say, a divorce that you're in the process of going through. Maybe, you know, it's pretty much complete, but you're just in that really sluggish, painful, frustrating part of it, legal, whatever, that just, it's awful right now, okay? Take that whole suffering around that, the heartbreak, the hurt, the betrayal, the pain, the financial stress, everything around that, and just stop and look at it and say, what might I be here to learn from this? Let's just assume that you left heaven to come here, among other reasons, to experience this exact thing that you're experiencing right now. You intended to experience it so that you could learn what? And think about that. Think deeply about it. Think as deeply as it takes to start coming to answers. And the moment you feel a little bit of resistance, let's just say you're thinking, maybe I needed to learn how to really love somebody else properly because maybe I didn't do it right. Now, you're going to have massive amounts of resistance around that. You're going to have, no, but he was the one who, or she was the one who, yes, that's not the point. Set that aside. Let that excuse just drift on by like a cloud and say, so what? That's not the point. I am here to learn what I can learn from this experience. And if you feel that resistance, no, because he did this or she did that, that is a clue that you may be on the right, in the right, you know, looking in the right direction. Why? Because a lesson is not truly learned unless it is tested on every level. And that resistance that you feel, the fighting against what might be the deeper truth that you came here to learn, usually for most of us, those lessons take years or decades to figure out. It may be when you're an old man looking back on your life and saying, you know what, I went through many years of bitterness and anger, frustration around it, and I'm realizing now, I can see now, I had problems too. I had things that I could have done differently. I could have treated her differently. I could have spoken to her differently. I could have been more gentle. And maybe things would have worked out. Maybe it wouldn't have been best for them too. I don't, you know. But I played my part in it too. And that lesson is maybe not be so much of, you know, it may be partly taking responsibility, but it may also be, if that's the case, if there was something that I was lacking or did wrong, what can I do differently the next time? How can I be better the next time around? What is it that would have made the difference? And next time I'll do that. And as you have that next time and you do that, you find, oh, this is what marriage was supposed to be. This is always what it was supposed to be. And it took maybe a couple of really bad marriages to discover that. And I think that's valuable because in this childlike form that we are, in this life suffering, going through difficulty and struggle, if we can pinpoint what it is that we might be supposed to be learning right now, we can shortcut those 20, 50 years that it takes for the lessons to just slowly seep in. We could say, you know what, this is really hard right now, and maybe I'm in the wrong too. Doesn't necessarily mean that I should stop trying to finish this divorce. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, I don't know, but what is it that I should be learning from it? And don't shortchange the process, because it's going to be painful, and you're going to be tempted to just brush over, oh yeah, I guess I had my part too, so I, you know, okay. Anyway, and moving on. That's not good enough. That's not good enough. That's not going to really teach you the lesson. Say, what can I change? Don't shame yourself. Don't shame yourself about anything that you're doing wrong. That's not going to help you. It's only going to make you struggle with the other lessons around shame that you're going to have to overcome with time. Look at it. Even if you have to do a little bit of a mental or spiritual life review, stepping back, objective, see it from a distance, almost as if you're watching somebody else's life and saying, huh. And instead of jumping to conclusions about it or jumping to defense or, you know, even for the other person and getting after yourself, don't do that. Stop and say, what does this person have to learn from it? Referring to yourself, of course. What could be learned from this? What is the lesson? And then as you have ideas about that, as you have thoughts about what might be the intended lesson, step forward into that lesson. You could be wrong. You might have the lesson wrong. And if that's the case, then just stop when you discover that and reevaluate and say, well, okay, that wasn't the lesson. What is the lesson? Maybe the lesson was not, you know, in the case of the divorce, you catch yourself and you realize, oh, maybe it was partly me too, and maybe I was partly at fault. And you start taking that approach of, maybe I need to really learn to love properly. And you start moving along that path. And if you find that, yes, there will be resistance if you're on the right track, but there can also be, if you find yourself in a worse situation or almost like deeper into the very problem that you're facing, then just pause, take another walk, do some more prayer, meditation, and think, what is it? It probably wasn't that lesson that I thought it was. Maybe it wasn't that. And then reevaluate, look again. What if it's that I have never had proper, true self-respect for myself, proper love for myself? Maybe that's why I let myself get so trampled on, so abused, you know, emotionally. Is there something that I, you know, and then try working down that path. Do it all prayerfully. Do it, you know, consciously. And if that makes things start to open up, yes, there will be resistance, but if you can feel things, I get it, and things start to open up, then continue down that path. And you may be able to, like Pat, find that within just a year or two, you've learned the lessons that you came here to learn. And I think you'll quickly find that when you've learned those lessons that you came here to learn, and there may still be some coming down the line, and so be prepared for that, but don't walk on eggshells through life. Play. Enjoy your time. And make the best of it. And when the next lesson comes, follow that same practice. Because we're here for reasons beyond our knowledge. We're shielded from and protected from knowing what those reasons are. It's only in experiencing them, actually experiencing those lessons, that we can truly learn them. Don't shame yourself over anything you've done. Just change where you need to change. Learn what you need to learn. And allow yourself to play and enjoy the process. It's not easy. But think how worth it it will be to be able to get to the end of our lives and say, wow, what a ride. That was incredible. And then think beyond that, in returning to this beautiful place we call home, how we'll be able to share that with others and say, you guys, this life that you're getting ready to go on, it's incredible. It's incredible. Don't shy away from the lessons that you're there to learn. Don't shy away from playing and enjoying it. Don't shy away from purpose when you feel it calling you. Live life to the fullest. We are here to experience. We are here to do. So do. If you would like to support the podcast, you can do so by either purchasing my book, Life in the Spirit World, or my album, Home. You can also join our Patreon page, and you can contact me by emailing Chaz, C-H-A-S, at ndepodcast.org. And once again, you guys, thanks so much for listening.